You're listening to author Sue Brain, and I'm delighted to welcome you back to this third series of Embracing Your Mortality. Yet again, I've got a great lineup of guests, all of whom put living consciously for a better world at the heart of what they do. The aim of this third series is to gather together leading thinkers, scientists, and sages to explore why engaging with our mortality matters.
Everybody should have the opportunity to volunteer with people at end of life, because boy, does it change your perspective on how to live.
They include the most fun funeral director in existence.
What a funeral does is place everybody in that room in time.
A hospice nurse who is providing emotional support to businesses.
Empathy is very much about walking alongside that person, not trying to fix it, not trying to make it better in any way.
An earth medicine man who works with plant medicine.
The more you speak, then the more you hear as well. I think we're slowly remembering how to talk to the plants and to the other forms of life.
And my final guest is a world-leading expert in near-death experiences, end-of-life experiences, and consciousness.
Love and light is a foretaste of what's coming.
And if you haven't already, don't forget to listen to the first two series of Embracing Your Mortality. Links to my guests in both series can be found on my website, suebrain.co.uk. Even though we're going through increasingly challenging times, I hope all these conversations from all three series inspire you to embrace your mortality so you too can live more consciously for a better world. Oncology nurse Rosie Ellis and psychiatrist Dr. Lauren McDonald have joined forces to create the Essence Medicine Institute, which provides psycho-spiritual care and support for people facing life-limiting illnesses and for people who want to explore their relationship with mortality, death, and dying. I'd like to start off with you, Lauren. You had stage 4 cancer, didn't you?
I started off being diagnosed when I was stage 2, and that was when I was 29 years old. So I was diagnosed with malignant melanoma, and at the time of diagnosis, it was very much still just localized to one area on my leg. Unfortunately, over the next few years, it spread first to my lymph nodes, then to my adrenal gland, lung, and then up to my chest wall. So at one point, I really did have quite a significant tumor burden throughout my body. And I'd had numerous surgeries over quite a few years, but it always felt like it was a game of cat and mouse. I just didn't feel that we were getting on top of the cancer. And although I'd have periods, maybe like 6 months, where my scans showed no cancer, there was always just this lingering feeling that it wasn't going to be long before the cancer returned. And I think because I knew it was such an aggressive cancer, it had a really high, what's called mitotic rate. So it was, when it was there, it was really growing and proliferating really quickly. I just spent about three years being absolutely terrified. Even during the periods of time where on my scans it showed no evidence of disease, there was always just this lingering feeling of it's going to come back, it's going to be really aggressive, ultimately I'm going to die of this, because melanoma doesn't respond well to chemotherapy or radiotherapy. So I very much knew that surgery was my only option. It was only when I was finally able to access cutting-edge immunotherapy that I was able to finally get to a place where the cancer was under control. And I remember my consultant first saying to me, if you get to 1 year in remission, you can breathe a tiny bit more of a sigh of relief. If you get to 2 years, breathe a little bit deeper. And he said, if you manage to get to 5 years, you can take a good deep breath out. But he just said, you know, with melanoma especially, it's such a notorious aggressive cancer that you'll probably never truly take a really big deep exhale. That definitely is the case, although I think with the benefit of time and all the things that we're probably going to get into on this conversation, I definitely don't live with that sense of fear anymore. But my journey with cancer and just the kind of facing my mortality, being told at one point I had about 12 months to live, really made me face all those kind of huge fears and brought up so much existential crisis, really, and spiritual crisis. And I was only 30, 31 at the time. It's a really young age to be facing your mortality. One positive that I've kind of taken away from it is all the lessons and gifts that you do get when you're faced with something like that so young. And that's really what's led me to the current work.
Rosie, how did you meet Lauren?
I watched Lauren talk with Drug Science at a Women in Psychedelics online event. And I was just really touched by what she shared. I kind of sat with what she'd said for a little while. And then I wrote to her the next day.
Rosie and I met about 6 months ago and things have moved really quickly. And in many ways, I think I was seeking someone in this space.
Just explain to me what your vision is.
Essence Medicine Institute has really come about because I obviously work as a medical doctor, but within psychiatry, kind of my own patient experience, it's just given me all these insights. But I was really looking for somebody who has been on the other side. So Rosie, when she reached out to me, was just so beautiful. The fact that she's worked as a palliative care nurse for so long. Because obviously I've not actually experienced caring for patients in that way. I'm very much, within my own patient story. But I knew that the things I'd experienced, the kind of 4 a.m. wakings, I'm feeling really terrified, really alone, I'm really scared of the actual dying process itself. You know, I'd kind of be lying in bed thinking about what is it going to look like for me to die? What's going to happen to my body? And then I was just really terrified of the finality of death because I didn't have any religious background, any spiritual practices at that time. So for me, the idea of dying and death was just so final. And it really did terrify me in the middle of the night when I was lying there on my own. So it was only through chatting to Rosie that I was able to start to understand that actually these are really human responses to this. This isn't just something I was going through. This is really what so many patients experience. It's that kind of existential fear, none of us really know what happens when we die. Different people have different ideas, but the unknown, the not knowing is really scary. So really we wanted to do something, create something that would be able to provide a bit of a container to hold people who are facing life-threatening illness.
So Rosie, just tell me a little bit more about your own vision for what the Institute is and why you're so pressed to do this.
Yeah, I guess since I very first started caring for people at the end of their lives, when I was 19, it always really touched me, and I kind of felt the sacredness and the beauty of that process, the dying process. And then over my career, I've just seen the ways that we don't handle death so well, and especially in certain settings. And of course, there are pressures and all sorts of things that make that very difficult. But I just sort of really noticed the huge disconnection that we have with death, even in settings where people are dying very regularly. That goes for health professionals as well. It's very difficult to talk about. It's very difficult to be with every single day. And then even in the hospice, people were very afraid, more psychosocial support, clubs. They are doing things incredibly well. There's a lot more support there. But even so, I really noticed the fear.
The death is part of the human condition, as we know. And I'm just so curious why we struggle so much with it. There's a beautiful Aboriginal saying, which I completely live and die by, which is basically, you know, you're just passing through this life and, you know, we're here to learn, to grow, to love, and then we return home. And I find that teaching really beautiful, but we just don't get it.
Home is something that Rosie and I talk a lot about, even though none of us know what happens when we die. Intuitively, there's a sense of it's going to be a homecoming. We're going to be going back to a place where we've been before, and there's comfort in that. And I think the more we can use the word home actually to talk about death and dying, there's something really beautiful in that as well. And just to your question of why why we don't really talk about it, why it's not there, why it's not taken to be part of life. I really don't know, to be honest. I think it's something about our Western culture, because obviously in other cultures, it's absolutely not the case. You know, death is celebrated and people are paraded through the streets when they die, and really it's seen and visible. And yeah, even, you know, as an NHS doctor, it's so interesting how often if someone had died on the ward, quickly the curtain would go round, and as a doctor, we'd be asked to go and kind of pronounce them dead. And yet, and then it was just also clinical and also hidden. Not that I was expecting kind of rose petals to be, it was kind of scattered there, or, but I just thought we could make something more ceremonial or sacred about it, about this really kind of monumental moment of someone's life.
The closing of their story, isn't it? The book closes. Both of you are very, very interested in the whole psychedelic research that's been going on in the States about helping people to die in a different way. And I just wondered if you could talk to me a little bit about that. I know it's illegal in this country, so it's not possible even to begin to go there, but I know you've got an interest in it. So just wanted to hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, there's been some lovely studies done in the States and then in Switzerland as well, using psychedelics, so psilocybin and LSD, for patients that have cancer or other life-limiting illnesses and depression and anxiety. They've shown that psilocybin and LSD have very quick effects at reducing anxiety and depression, and also produce just really profound experiences where people are able to process what is happening to them in a way that perhaps they haven't been able to before. So it always really struck me when I read the qualitative research, just some of the things that people said that felt really wise and incredibly moving. So, you know, people meeting their cancer and seeing their cancer, kind of understanding messages about why they have their illness, realizing things about themselves and their lives and what's most important to them, experiencing a kind of sense of continuity. Reading about this kind of got me really excited. We're not really able to explore this in any other way that I know of. Yes, and I think as well, I just want to add that, you know, they won't be for everybody. I think, you know, some people definitely won't want to use psychedelics, and there will be limitations around who can access them. So dependent on what type of disease you have, what type of medication you take. It just really struck me from the moment I started reading about them. Yeah, there's something really special here.
And Lauren, do you want to add to that? Because I know you have a personal interest in this too.
I mean, I have a personal interest in that I've actually had my own psychedelic experience. I went off to the Netherlands when I was actually in remission, but I had come across the research that Rosie's been mentioning, and there was one particular study and then a TED talk that I watched with Roland Griffiths, who's a professor at Johns Hopkins, and he just spoke about how the patients that had gone through his research trial had had such profound shifts in how they thought about their cancer and their fear of dying. And because I knew I still had this lingering fear of recurrence, I thought, I'll just give it a go. I had nothing to lose, but I did feel that I was still very much stuck in survival mode and that something needed to shift for me to really kind of enter back into my life and start living again. So I went off to the Netherlands in 2019 and had a really incredible experience, very cathartic. It wasn't all easy. There was lots of tears as well. But in amongst all of that, there were some huge insights. I got to connect and kind of be with cancer patients who I'd met on the chemotherapy unit who have since died. And they were able to share information with me, things like, you know, letting me know that even if the cancer comes back, when I die, when my physical body dies, I will continue, my essence will continue. And really that's where the inspiration for Essence Medicine Institute actually came from, because this sense of our essence going beyond our death, I think it's really comforting as well. The finality of death used to scare me so much. And Now I have this deep knowing. It's not just an intellectual hypothesizing. It's very much a deep knowing that when my physical body is no longer here, I will, in some way, my essence will continue. And there were so many other beautiful insights that, that came through my journey. A lot of it was around love and being love and feeling connected to everyone and just the oneness of the universe.
The other thing that was really notable was that they allowed people to really feel their grief, their sadness, their anger, spoke about how that was a very healing experience for them because they hadn't properly been able to do so before.
And that's what you experienced yourself, Lauren, that sort of sense of really meeting who you were and actually owning who you were, I guess.
Very much so. And it really was, I can, there almost was a before psychedelic experience and after psychedelic experience me, because I think I was still holding on to a lot of anxiety and I was really shut down, to be honest. I think I'd been quite traumatized by my cancer experience and hadn't received that psychological, spiritual care that I now realize is so important. So really having my psychedelic experience, and it wasn't just the psychedelic, it was the fact that it was held in a really safe space with amazing facilitators as well. But after that, I just felt much more grounded in myself. I'd really come back to myself and really, my nervous system just felt much more kind of relaxed and was really in that parasympathetic state and could kind of reflect back on my experience with cancer with the gratitude, you know, gratitude for certain aspects of the experience and just much more peace. And I think in lots of ways, it kickstarted almost a period of post-traumatic growth.
I think this is really, for me, tying up with a lot of the near-death experience studies I've been doing. And I've read so many stories now and worked on and researched end-of-life experiences. And those of us who are lucky enough to have those glimpses of the other, something else going on. In my experience of talking to people who've had a near-death experiences is they come back with a sense of this is not home, that's, you know, this other place where I will go to. And every one of them talks about this incredible transcendent love that they experience. Mm. I'm really interested that you've had that experience through psychedelics, Lauren.
Mine very much was through psychedelics, but there are other ways that you can get there as well. Like you said, the near-death experiences, I know practices like holotropic breathwork, anything that can help you get to a kind of non-ordinary state of consciousness. I think sometimes you can get it, you can get glimpses of it at least if you watch an epic sunrise or anything that kind of takes you out of yourself, just makes you kind of in awe of the oneness of everything. Yeah. And the beauty. And I think that's the thing. It's as passionate as we are about psychedelics, and we are really passionate about their promise, especially with the end of life population or anyone who's got life threatening illness. I think as well there are lots of other practices that can help us to open up to our interconnectedness, the love that you talked about, and I think that's also really healing and just supportive for people as well.
I want to bring Rosie back in here because we're talking about holotropic breathing. For people don't understand that, what does that mean, Rosie?
The holotropic breathing was a kind of style of breath work birthed by Stan Grof and his wife. It's a type of fast breathing that other cultures use, and you just alter your breathing so that you're breathing at a more fast rate. It can produce some very profound effects, and it has to be done safely in a held way. So holotropic breathwork is not something to do on your own. It's definitely a big experience, similar to a psychedelic experience.
The other thing, Rosie, I'm really interested in is this whole sense of how do we hold people safely to have these experiences at the end of their life, especially when they're experiencing cancer or, you know, they're living with a lot of fear and panic and chaos. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to talk to you about this sort of sense of creating ceremony for them and taking them beyond the clinical medical care.
Yeah, well, when I think back over my time working in the hospice, a really important aspect is creating safety and trust and a sense that it's okay to let go. And people can be very agitated and feel like they have to keep going and keep doing and doing and doing. And knowing they're really, really held, I think, can allow people to just relax a bit and perhaps access more of these experiences potentially. And it's still something we'll be learning, and we'll be hoping to learn from others. We're not saying that we know all of this stuff. We're very much hoping that Essence Medicine will invite other people in that have experienced these things.
Lauren, I'm going to come back to you then, just about your experience of being held in that kind of ceremony.
It was actually a 4-day retreat, and the ceremony was just on the third day. So I had a few days when I arrived of really kind of connecting with all the other guests who were there and the facilitators, and spending lots of time in nature, doing lots of body practices, things like Qigong and meditation, and a few group activities as well, which just really helped us to kind of let down our guard more than anything. And then on the day of the actual ceremony, we all lay down in a beautiful room. They'd made it look really special, and there was an altar in the middle, so we all brought pieces to place on the altar, and it really was done in ceremony. We set intentions, there was beautiful music, and it was a inward experience, so we were encouraged to drink the truffle tea that they that you can buy the truffles over legally in the Netherlands. And then we drank the tea and then put an eye mask on. And we're encouraged to really stay inwards for the whole 6-hour experience, because I think that's where really the magic happens in psychedelic therapy. It's when the invitation is to go inwards rather than just looking at the maybe patterns that are emerging or the beauty. Because I know a lot of people in the past, you know, especially in the 60s and 70s when psychedelics were first around, which is probably what people still to this day remember, it was very much about looking at nature and the beauty. And it's not to say that that's not important, because I think psychedelics have a huge role in potentially helping us to save this planet and really care for our Earth again. But in terms of the healing that you can get from going inwards, I know I wouldn't have got any of those huge insights if I hadn't have done that. And it goes back to what Rosie was saying about when she is there for people as they're dying. And there was a sense of needing to let go and needing to surrender to the psychedelic experience. And I think in that way, there's a lot of kind of crossover and similarity with the dying process, because Rosie said to me before, so often she sees the people that really struggle at the end of life, at the very end of life, are the people that are clinging on and not letting go. Mm. We're not taught to surrender. We're not taught to let go.
Rosie, I'd like to come back to you on that, because obviously this is what you've had a lot of experience around. So, you know, this whole concept of letting go and how some people really struggle with that. And why do you think that is?
People are very afraid. They don't know what's coming for them, and none of us do. But if you don't have a religion or beliefs that kind of comfort you and make it safe, or make it feel like you can let go, it can be very difficult. And people also have dreams they haven't fulfilled, things they haven't said, unfinished business that make it extremely hard to let go, and a sense of, you know, is it okay? What will happen? And people will tell you things about their life, things they've done. Often people get quite reflective, and generally most people look back on their life with fondness, gratitude and happiness for their life, even if their life has sounded quite hard. But you do, and that's one of the beautiful things about this work and what an honour it is. You hear people say some very wise and profound things as well, which is just amazing to witness. Like several other people talking about the environment and how important it is to protect the environment in their last days, which I found really interesting. So people reflecting on the majesty of nature and the beauty of nature and how we need to care for nature.
Yeah, I can imagine it really bringing that to the fore. Lauren, when you were having your own experiences with the psychedelics, did you feel a sort of deepening connection with the essence of life itself?
I did, and it's so interesting, because there was, you transcend time and space and place, and I did actually have some really beautiful connections with my ancestors. So my grandparents came up for me and very much on the maternal line. So it was all my grandmas and great grandmas, and it went back and back. And I just had this real sense of when I speak, I'm actually speaking their wisdom as well, their truth, their lived experiences. And actually I hold that within myself. There was a real sense of speak your truth, speak up, you know, your voice is needed. It was really comforting and really inspiring for me to kind of propel me forward on this journey as well.
Rosie, is part of the vision for the Institute is to provide that kind of spiritual or existential support?
I've just been looking into really what does spirituality mean? How are we going to communicate this? Because it's a very personal thing. It's, you know, some people are religious and have very deep religious beliefs. And Lauren shared a definition with me the other day, which is just, it can be this kind of connection to something bigger than ourselves. And I think that's something possibly most of us have sensed at one point in our life. We don't want to be prescriptive. We want it to be something that can reach as many people as possible. And for people as well to be able to explore what spirituality means to them.
Lauren, you know, with your own experience of the psychedelics, did that really open up that spiritual experience for you in your relationship with yourself and how you view yourself now?
I was very much an atheist before my illness, but definitely before I'd taken psychedelics. Having said that, I do think that I had some kind of what I can only describe as awakening the night of my actual diagnosis, because I lay awake all night just thinking a few key questions. One of them was, has my life had meaning? Has me existing on this earth had meaning? Have I helped people? Have I done enough with my time here? And the other big thing that came up was about love. And it was a sense of, have I loved enough? And also, have I let myself be loved enough? Nothing to do with psychedelics. Often they're the things that do come up for people on psychedelic journeys. But it was interesting that I almost had a bit of an opening, an awakening, just purely by, like you said, there's a thick veil normally, isn't there, that prevents us from thinking about our death and thinking about our life, really, really reflecting on it. And it was as if that night there was a crack in it. And then my psychedelic experience a few years later kind of absolutely dissolved the veil. It's exactly what you said. It's that thick veil that prevents us, I think, from really, truly living the lives that we could be living. And it's so tragic that it often takes a life-threatening illness to wake you up to that.
That was Rosie Ellis and Dr. Lauren McDonald, two remarkable women determined to make the end of life more comfortable for us all. For more information about Rosie and Lauren and the work they're doing, please go to essencemedicineinstitute.com. Ah, my final guest is Dr. Peter Fenwick, a world-leading expert in near-death experiences, who was also my boss while I was his honorary researcher for our study into end-of-life experiences. Truly an early Christmas special.
As soon as you become aware of the central column of light within you, which always goes with love, so love and light are the chief components of you, the soul, if you like.
You've been listening to Embracing Your Mortality, and I look forward to you joining me again next time. In the meantime, here's to us all living more consciously for a better world.
The Embracing Your Mortality podcast was researched and recorded by Sue Brain and produced and edited by The Podcast Den.